Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. We're back on the economy today, and that's always a focus topic on this program because the hot times for most people in the country are not going away. And I'll make a quick comment after I introduce my guest and then let him explain from his latest writing his analysis and thoughts on what's going on. I'm talking about Jack Rasmus, and Jack does just exceptional writing on economic issues. He's a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University in California. Oh, he's also a freelance journalist. He's a speaker, a playwright, an author. His latest book is called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. And he's got a new book coming out this year, maybe shortly. It's called Obama's Economy, Stagnation and Collapse, 2008 to 2010. Let me just make a quick comment. Another one of my regulars on the program, Bob Chapman, he writes the International Forecaster. He puts out a lengthy report twice a week. In his new report that came out today, he makes comments like this. It looks like it's been decided that the European debt will collapse first. And he says the ECB, the Eurozone, IMF meeting in Athens this coming week will decide it. We expect default, but what the numbers will be, no one knows. A default of 40 to 70% possibly. If the bankers insist on collateral, such as almost all the Greek government assets, that will be, he says, no partial default. Maybe he means in partial default. Anyway, he says, if they insist on whatever they may want from Greece in their pound of flesh, quote, it will mean full default. He sees big trouble coming, Jack, beginning in Europe, and I guess whatever cracks open in Europe is heading for America.
Well, I had predicted in my book published 15 months ago that, among other things, there would be one or more sovereign debt defaults, one or more, that is, more, in Europe before the next couple of years. And that raises the risk of another global financial crisis. If it's just Greece, they probably will be able to contain it temporarily, but if it sets off a chain reaction elsewhere in Europe, Portugal, Ireland, etc., because Irish people aren't as aware of Ireland, but Ireland's having trouble again meeting the early arrangements, you should say. But keep in mind that these sovereign debt crises are really bank crises, because it's the banks that have loaned these sovereign nations all the money, and that's why what's going on in Europe is an interesting political event, and that is to see if they can push the cost of it all on the folks who didn't cause it.
Oh, absolutely.
Population.
Absolutely.
But it's the banks who don't want to pay. You see, there's a big battle between will the banks bankers take a haircut on this debt or not? And they're going back and forth, and bankers so far have been able to get the governments to make the people pay, but they're making them pay so much. And given the different political histories in Europe, and people tend to get upset and do things quicker, they're having trouble making everybody swallow that huge amount. They're choking on it to pay for it. So the debate's been going on for some time, particularly among the Germans. Well, we should have the banks pay a little bit, you know? Well, the banks don't want to pay anything. And that's what's going on in Europe. It's not just an economic event in development, you know, the debt and defaulting on the debt, but it's really a political development at the same time.
Jack, you know what happened in Iceland recently. For the second time, they had a referendum. They actually let the people vote. Whether the vote will mean anything, I don't know. But both times, the people in Iceland voted no about repaying the debt to the British government. And I mean, Iceland has literally been wrecked, but they simply don't want to pay the debt that they're not responsible for. Now, whether the government will go along with this, or whether the government may even fall if it refuses to go along with what the people want, I guess we'll have to see. And I have no idea why they had two referenda on this, but they did. One a year or so ago, and one in the past month or so. And both times, the Icelanders said, we don't want to pay back these banks. We had nothing to do with this crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, solve your own problem.
Well, same thing just happened in Finland. They had an election in Finland, and the party that won ran and won on a platform of, no, we're not going to bail somebody else out at our own expense. So things are fracturing politically and economically in Europe. Europe's certainly the weak spot, and not just on the financial side, but, you know, once again, it's pretty clear the U.K. is slipping back quickly into a recession again, largely escalated or accelerated, I should say, because of the program of the Cameron government, which was big austerity, even worse austerity than we have here. Well, that's thrown them right back into recession. It's an interesting example of what's going to happen here in the United States if the Tea Publicans and the Timidcrats get together and enable some additional cuts. You know, we're already slowing down. And another thing I had predicted in my book, that the recovery from the 2008 collapse is going to be a stagnant, uneven, up-and-down kind of recovery. And there was no true sustained recovery. I wrote about that in 2009. In other words, it will be short recoveries, short and shallow recoveries followed by relapses and declines that may be short and shallow too, and bouncing up and down, very much like what happened after the financial crisis here in the United States in 1907. For 7 years it was up and down, small dip recessions and so forth. And by the way, we had a small dip last summer, you know, very clearly. The stock market, of course, didn't dip. But what happened was we had 4 months in a row where we had additional direct job losses. We had foreclosures running at 300,000 a month for 3 months in a row. So the economy, and there was concern that we were going to slip into deflation again last summer. And that's why Bernanke threw in QE2. In other words, QE2 pump in $600 billion more quickly into the economy. So we had our first little double dip. It didn't register as a real negative drop in GDP because of the funny way we do GDP. We always overestimate it. But after the QE2 last October, pumping in $600 billion, which is now coming to an end, we got a little bump in the economy back up, but now it's slipping again very clearly. And in addition to the fundamental developments that were at work in the economy, you know, the fragility, as I call it in my book, now we got overlaid on top of that the rising prices that are cutting into everybody's income. And on top of that, now we got the deficit cutting going on at the federal and state and local government level. Okay? No consumption, 70% of the economy, except for the wealthiest 10% households. They are now consuming 60% of all consumption is done by the wealthiest 10%. So they're buying because the stock market doubled in 18 months. So, you know, they make a lot of income from the stock market, top 10% households. So they've been buying, but no one else has been buying. So consumption is flat, and now with rising prices, it's going to get even flatter. Well, now it's going negative. The stock market has peaked, I believe. And now we're going to cut the government spending significantly at all levels. Well, that is a formula guaranteed for a double-dip recession, which is coming.
Oh, I believe it. I believe it, Jack. And let me give you the punchline from Bob Chapman's beginning of a very long report today. He says, talking about Europe again, he says, we do not believe Americans or most of Europe understand the impact of the European banking crisis. The meeting in Athens next week to restructure Greek debt probably will trigger an EU-wide banking crisis, which we have been warning about for the past 2 years. We do not see the Greeks, Irish, or Portuguese living in poverty for the next 50 years just to make sure the bankers get their money back, which, of course, they created out of thin air and stole a hell of a lot more, created it and stole it, et cetera, and so on. That's a pretty bleak outlook, and he's been on this thing repeatedly, week after week after week, and as you say, a lot of this stuff is the push is coming to shove. And I don't know how you can shove this stuff under the carpet forever, and even the QE, Jack, as you know, it may have bumped the economy a little bit, but it certainly has not on Main Street. There's real suffering on Main Street, and now if they pull back a little bit, combined with austerity in so-called budgeting going into next year, I just can't imagine what's going to happen.
Well, QE2 really did two things. One, it pumped up, kept the stock market going. Okay, and that was its real domestic objective. The other objective was it drove the dollar down. Okay, and stimulated U.S. exports. Those two things it did do, manufacturing exports, okay? It had no effect whatsoever on the housing market. It didn't lower long-term rates at all. So no impact on housing, but it did lower the value of the dollar, which, of course, has played a significant role in the run-up in prices now that we're seeing. So it's raised inflation on import goods, and we know that inflation for commodities, it set off a commodity speculation boom globally. And we're seeing the results of that. You know, oil prices, gasoline at the pump up 30, 40, 50%. Just about every other commodity is up 30, 40, 50%. Everything from, you know, copper to cotton to sugar to grains to so forth. And it's raising the price of living significantly in the United States. In fact, the rise in gasoline prices alone has eaten up two-thirds of the $100 billion stimulus that was forthcoming as a result of cutting the payroll tax 2%. Okay, we cut the payroll tax from 6.2 to 4.2 for employees, and that released $100 billion for spending. That was Obama's last hurrah in terms of stimulus. But the oil companies have eaten it all up, so really what we've done, in effect, is transfer $100 billion from the Social Security Trust Fund to the oil companies.
Oh, indeed, Jack.
And we've got no effect out of it.
And besides the oil companies, I mean, the price of food has been skyrocketing as well.
Well, because a lot of the food comes from offshore, comes from global trading, commodities, and so forth. And a lot of the food is produced with chemicals, which means oil, essentially. A lot of manufacturing companies have to absorb the oil price increase in producing everything. So oil impacts food prices in a number of ways in the United States. And what we got, of course, is escalating commodity prices and therefore escalating food prices. And as a result, for the average household, in terms of real earnings, spendable earnings, they're down less than where they were 15 months ago. In other words, we're making less today than we were in January 2010, the average household. You can't get a recovery with that. You know, consumption is 70% of the economy, and you're cutting people's real spendable income and giving it to the oil companies and to, you know, other speculators who are speculating in these commodities. You just can't get a recovery. And, you know, the last time we had this was in the spring and summer, this commodity price boom, spring and summer of 2008, right before the big collapse. So that tells you, the pressures are growing for another double digit. And then, incredibly, on top of this, we're cutting government spending at all levels. It's amazing, how ignorant people are in Congress and especially among the Tea Publicans, as to what the economic effects of all this are going to be.
Well, even the policy advisors, I just can't imagine what these people are telling Obama. They understand what's going on, and they understand the harm of these budget cuts at a time where the economy is very shaky. But I guess politics always trumps common sense, Jack. So,
well, it's not all ignorance. There are many people who are ignorant, who don't understand what they're doing. But there are people among the Tea Publicans and the conservatives and big corporations who know exactly what they're doing, and who want to cut government spending because they want to protect their tax cuts. You see, they know that you either have to raise taxes or cut spending, and they know the Bush tax cuts are the big target, and corporations are the big target because they're doing quite well. If you look at what's happened, the gainers since Obama introduced his program in 2009, it's pretty clear. Stock market up 100%, the Dow's up 100%, the NASDAQ is at its highest since 2000. This is the biggest, fastest increase in 60 years in the stock market. The stock market has snapped back. Fastest growth in 60 years, the largest increase since 1982. The S&P 500 has doubled their valuation to over $12 trillion. Bond markets, junk bonds, 20% gain in 2009, 57% gain in 2010, and another 25% this year. Corporate profits, double-digit gains, and I don't mean 10, 11%, I mean 30, 40% every quarter for the last seven quarters. Stock markets almost where it was in 2007, and above where it was in 2008. Annual rate of increase in corporate profits since 1998 has been about 10%. Now hold on to your seat. How much did corporate profits increase in 2009? 243%.
Oh, my goodness.
Of course, that was from a very low. But let's take a more balanced year, 2010. How much did it increase? 51%.
Mm.
In the first quarter of this, of 2011, another 40%. Profit margins at an 80-year high. You can figure out who the big gainers are, and it's not surprising that with those huge gains in the corporations, that they're sitting on $2 trillion of cash. Now, you got to tie that into extending the Bush tax cuts in December, because by extending those Bush tax cuts, the corporations now can take a good part of that $2 trillion in cash and give it back to their big stockholders in capital gains, stock buybacks, dividends, and so forth. That's why they extended that for two more years. So this huge gain in the stock and bond markets can be realized by the big wealthiest investors.
Jack, with all this money being pumped into the economy, why on earth have not long bond rates increased, especially long treasuries?
Well, because by buying up long-term bonds as part of the QE thing, right? By buying up long-term bonds, QE1 and QE2, they've been able to hold down the yield as a result.
So the Fed buying has really been the impetus in keeping rates down.
Yes, that was the whole idea. But the rates have not come down that much. I mean, figure it out. QE1 was $1.75 trillion. QE2 is another $600 billion. So you're pumping in over $2 trillion. And what kind of a decrease did you get in long-term bond rates? Let's take the mortgage market. That's long-term bonds, mortgage bonds, 30-year bonds. How much did they come down? 1%. 1%. We spent $2 trillion and we get a 1% decline, and it's going back up, by the way, in the long-term bond market.
Well, that's what's on my mind. At least nominally, QE will end. I honest to God don't think it'll end. I think it'll continue. Just they simply won't call it QE. It'll be something else. I mean, if China doesn't buy our bonds, Japan probably has to sell them because they have their own financial headache. The Fed will have to pick up the slack and buy what the market will not buy on its own. So they won't talk about QE3. I talk about QE ad infinitum because the Fed will just keep pumping out the money and buying up treasury short, medium, long term. And won't that keep pressure on keeping rates down?
Well, they got a contradiction here. Okay, they're trying to keep the stock market going, trying to stimulate the economy by very, very low rates. Of course, it's not working. I point that out in my book, in the next to last chapter, that the nature of a epic recession is that normal fiscal monetary policies do not work. They do not work very well. It takes a huge amount of liquidity injection into the economy to get a small amount of recovery. And conversely, any relatively minor amount of contraction in monetary policy, raising interest rates, will precipitate quickly another downturn. So monetary policy is broke as far as stimulating the economy is concerned. That's why you need massive fiscal intervention in order to get the economy back on a growth path.
But we're not getting it, except
the military. No, no. I mean, the two times we've had epic recessions in this country in the past were, 1907, and we bailed out the banks, but we got no fiscal stimulus, and the economy bumped along and stagnation for 7 years until we got the big fiscal stimulus, which was World War I. And in the other example, 1929, which started as an epic recession, we didn't bail out the banks, nor did we give fiscal stimulus, so we ended up in a series of four banking crises that drove us into the Depression. And we really didn't get out of the Depression until we have massive fiscal spending in World War II. Now, the dilemma today is that war spending does not get you the stimulus, because the nature of war production today is that it's not very labor-intensive. It's very high technological. You don't hire a lot of people. Plus, now the U.S. is a global empire, and we've farmed out a lot of our military production to our allies. So you can't get out of it with war spending. You can have, though, public investment of various forms, public spending, public investment as a way of stimulating the economy. But they won't do that. Obama won't do that, and we can see that very, very clearly. There is no public investment-driven projects to create jobs. We still have 25, 27 million unemployed, and you're never going to get a recovery with that many unemployed. And with the housing sector in veritable depression already, 75% down, with 10 million, one in five in foreclosure, and another 16 million underwater. Even the sector, manufacturing sector, which is about 10-11% of the economy, construction is about 10-11. In the manufacturing sector, we have a little bit of a recovery in manufacturing, but if you look at the production recovery in manufacturing we've had here in the last year and a half, in the past, that much of a recovery in production has generated about 370,000 jobs, but we've only generated 74,000 with that manufacturing recovery. So labor intensive anymore, and that's Obama's whole job program: stimulate manufacturing exports. It's not going to create any jobs.
Well, stimulating exports by depreciating the dollar.
Yes, that's exactly what's going on. But that brings us back to your initial point. By depreciating the dollar to stimulate exports, to stimulate the stock market, what do you get? You get a collapse in the value of the dollar going on, which means China and these other countries say, well, gee, I don't know if I want to buy bonds, dollar-denominated bonds, that are collapsing in value. So you're running the risk that they won't buy your bonds. And that's exactly what China is doing right now. China is setting up in Hong Kong a pilot project where essentially they're going to test and see whether the yuan can renminbi can become a global trading currency. That's going on right now. That's an ominous development.
Well, in the first 3-4 months of this year, Jack, they have been net sellers of U.S. Treasuries.
Mm-hmm. Slowly. They're very careful.
Slowly,
they
yeah.
don't want to drive down the value altogether, right?
Oh, well, hell, I mean, they own a mountain load of treasuries. So, as the dollar depreciates, and they just see their massive investment depreciate with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're sitting on the Titanic, but, they don't want to jump into the ocean. They just want to figure out the safest way they can escape from this monstrous trap they've gotten themselves into.
Well, they got a luxurious super yacht that's pulled up alongside the Titanic. They're not going to jump in the water. They're going to go down the rope to the yacht if they have to.
Well, they have a very prosperous economy, and they have a lot of control over the Bank of China.
Well, they are the Bank of China.
They are the Bank of China. I call it a quasi-public private bank. But what the Chinese government wants is what the bank does. And if they don't do it, then heaven help the people running the bank. I would not want to be a banker saying no to the Chinese government.
No. Well, and China's trying to transition to more domestic consumption-driven growth. Instead of exports, reliance on exports, because, you look at the West, industrial West, and, they're in financial trouble. They may not be buying so much exports in the future. So you got to rely more on your domestic consumption growth, which is what they're transitioning to.
Jack,
if
Bob Chapman is right, and we're sitting on the cusp of a European banking crisis, does this mean that the rosy story that you've unfolded with the tremendous growth in corporate profits, et cetera, and so on, even though the economy has not shown it in robust GDP growth, but the corporations have never had it better over the short term, if a banking crisis erupts in Europe, is that a complete game changer?
Oh, yeah, if it's a true banking crisis. But I don't know if I'm as... skeptical, I guess, as Bob Chapman, that the Greek default will precipitate a true euro-wide banking crisis. I think that's it's hard to predict that whether it will or not. They may be able to take Greece and reschedule that debt, and that's what it would be. That's what that's what a default is. Default simply means you can't make your payments, so you restructure your debt in some way. Pay less interest, drag it out longer, or something like that. I think they might be able to get away with restructuring Greek debt without a system-wide crisis over there. But if it's more than one country, then all the bets are off.
I think that's probably what he's thinking of, that, first you get Greece, and then Portugal is right behind them, and you get the other pick countries. Ireland is in terrible trouble, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if you get one, and it triggers another, and it triggers another, I mean, this could be like an unstoppable nuclear reaction.
Yeah, I think it'll take more than Greece, and then the big question will be Spain. Can you get one Greek Ireland or Greek Portugal, and will that precipitate Spain? Because Spain, while it's not well off, is not as bad off as the other three. But if Spain goes, then I think they'll all run for cover for themselves. Germany will take care of itself, and France will be forced to do the same. And then you got an unraveling over there. To what extent it extends over to U.S. banks, we'll find out. Because, of course, the Fed, when it bailed out U.S. banks to the tune of $9 trillion here after 2008, also spent $1 trillion bailing out the foreign banks, which means mostly European banks.
Oh, indeed so. And the way it looks to me, Jack, and you're the economist, I'm not, but it looks like we're sitting on very, very shaky ground, like a very earthquake-prone area. And, of course, in California, there you are, and anybody in Japan, there they are. But when you're sitting on a situation like that, you can simply, at any moment in time, you can be blindsided by a very, very bad surprise. And if it's bad enough...
Yes, you can. It's uncertainty, and that's the characteristic also of an epic recession. You get no true recovery, and the longer it goes on when you don't have a true recovery, the more likely that you are going to have another banking crisis. Okay, the true recovery eliminates the possibility of a second banking crisis. You know, but if you have a second banking crisis, you're like you were in 1930s. Okay, and the Depression is nothing but a series of banking crises that each time drive the economy down deeper and deeper and deeper. So you got to bail out the banks, okay, if you want to stabilize the economy as a starter. But bailing out the banks won't get you a recovery. It will get you what we got right now, which is corporations flush with cash and bankers, banks flush with cash because they can get free money from the Federal Reserve and then loan it out to us at 5-7%. In fact, they don't even get free money. The Fed is paying them to take free money from the Fed, because when the Fed gives the banks a loan at the 0.1% now, the banks then leave the money with the Fed, and the Fed pays them interest on it. So the Fed is actually paying them to take money for free.
It is shocking.
That's boggling.
It is shocking, Jack. I mean, imagine you or I being able to go to the Fed window and borrow a much smaller amount because we're one person, not a big bank, and then have the Fed pay us interest on this money we get virtually for nothing.
Yeah, and think about it this way, too. You know, all across the country, the states are blaming public workers and their pensions for the problem of their budget deficits, right? And estimates range from anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion in the public pension funding gap. Now, the gap is because of these pension funds since 2006 were speculating in derivatives and so forth with hedge funds, and they lost a lot of money. Also because for over 10 years now, the pension fund managers were declaring pension contribution holidays. In other words, not putting money in and manipulating actuarial assumptions as a way of not putting money in. So if you don't put money in for 10 years, and then on top of that you lose a lot in speculation, well then, of course, you're going to have a huge pension funding gap. And most of the gap occurred in the last 2 years, so that's an indicator that it was losses and speculation. Nonetheless, they're blaming public workers for this and for the, quote, state budget deficits, which are based on assumptions of continuing losses in the pension funds. Okay, so you got the Federal Reserve, which loaned $9 trillion to financial institutions. Well, pension funds are financial institutions. Why can't the Fed simply give the pension funds a $500 billion bridge loan at 0.1% that they gave other private banks? I mean, it's the same thing, right? We give $1 trillion to foreign banks. Why can't we give half of that to our own pension funds to help them get over the hump here? You know, I mean, that's an interesting contradiction, I think, why they won't give it. Well, they won't give it because the Tea Publicans and others really want to cut public employees and spending on the public sector. You see, you cause a crisis in the public sector, or you cause a crisis in deficits in general, as a way of attacking public spending and public programs as a way of solving the problem.
Oh,
even
absolutely.
Though it wasn't the cause of the problem.
Absolutely. My God, I've said it myself a number of times. You say it better, Jack, but absolutely. And the people always pay for the sins of those who are responsible for those sins. Let's take a quick break, Jack, and we'll come back and I'll let you pick. If Hollywood made a movie out of this, it would be a horror movie. We will be right back.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
We'll be right back. Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cummings.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
On with Jack Rasmus, talking about the state of the U.S. and global economy. Jack, let me throw in one thing, and that's Japan. They have, besides their other problems, they have the terrible problem from the disastrous earthquake, tsunami, nuclear calamity, which is really worse than the tsunami and the earthquake combined, in my opinion. I've written an awful lot about the radiation, the nuclear stuff going on, not paying attention to the tsunami or the earthquake or the economy. Well, tsunamis and earthquakes can be recovered from, but you irradiate one large portion of the country, and you don't come back from that in the lifetimes of anybody listening to this program, anybody living in Japan today. What do you think is the outlook for Japan with everything going on there?
Japan is already in I would say, an economic collapse, but it's darn close to it in terms of its economic activity. It's the contraction in the business and consumption that's going on right now, and the forecast for that is, in terms of their GDP, is as bad as it was during the worst period of the first quarter of 2009. Okay. Japan started recession back in early 2008. Their economy started going negative, and of course, when the U.S.-led global financial crisis occurred in the third quarter of 2008, Japan collapsed as well. Their GDP fell more than 5%, which is huge. And now it's already down approaching 4%. Okay, so it's in a it's in double dip, just as the UK is entering double dip, just as we are, one more step behind heading for double dip. Of Europe is already in double dip, they're still in the first dip.
Jack, though Japan has to do an enormous amount of spending to rebuild from what's gone on, and a question as well, I mean, if Japan gets into a dire state, as you're describing, Japan is a mighty important economy, the third largest in the world now. China passed them a year ago or so. But what will the effect of Japan have on the rest of the world economically?
Well, you can ask, what will it have on buying treasury bonds? What Japan's going to have to do is start selling their treasury bonds in order to pay for the recovery. So Japan is not going to buy as many bonds from the United States. And of course, we know China is trying to extricate themselves from that arrangement. Japan's sitting on, dollar-denominated reserves almost as large as China. Well, not almost, but, you know, almost $1 trillion. So it's a big player in terms of treasury bonds, and if they have to finance their recovery, you know, they're going to have to reduce their purchase of bonds and use that capital to finance their recovery. So it impacts us, in other words, seriously here. And, of course, you know, China and the U.S. have trade arrangements, they're going to be buying less of U.S. consumer goods in the process. So it's a significant development, okay, as is the austerity-driven recollapse of the U.K. economy. Those two things, and now the peripheral situation in Europe. And add to that the fact that China and Brazil and some of the other BRIC nations are trying to slow down their economies because the speculators now have focused on them and are driving up prices not only for commodities but for real estate in those countries and in their currencies and so forth. You know, the prospect for a robust global recovery, I believe, is declining, not increasing.
So we really have a mess, and it's not getting better.
Oh, yes.
It's getting worse.
It's definitely a mess. Yes. It's not getting better. It's weakening. But that's the nature of an epic recession, you see.
Jack,
it's not
Jack,
over.
So I don't forget.
It's not over.
When is your newest book coming out?
The new book, Obama's Economy, which, by the way, to correct your title, you know, in the introduction, is called Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few.
Ooh.
And it will be out at the end of the year. Okay. In the meantime, people can read a lot of what I'm writing about that will be in the book on my blog, which is just jackrasmus.com. JACKRASMUS.com, or on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com. But you can just go to Google me or go directly to the blog or sign up on the blog, and you'll get an email with my new writing, you might say, three or four times a month. I've been writing on the budget. We might want to talk about that. The budget
absolutely.
Deficit, which is going to heat up next week.
Well, your title, I guess you changed your title because the one I've been using, I think, was the original one. So now it's a little changed.
Yes. The emphasis is going to be in the new book, once again, as I predicted, an epic recession. It's sort of an extension of epic recession. Why we didn't get a recovery. Okay, with the Obama program. You know, why with $9 trillion of Fed stimulus of the banks, and why with $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus, why do only the few recover, corporations and wealthy households and stock markets, bond markets, why do they recover, but the rest of us don't? You know, you have to explain why that happened. Economists don't do that, they aren't doing that, because their whole approach and models are ineffective in explaining what's going on. But that's the key. Why do we not have this recovery broad-based? And what does it mean for the future? Does it mean just more of the same, or does it mean we're going to slip back in?
Good question. This is on my mind as well. Have we ever had, in this country, have we ever, in U.S. history, had a quote-unquote recovery like this one?
Yes, we did, in 1908 to 1914.
I mean in terms of it only benefiting the people right at the top and nobody else.
Yeah, 1908 to 1914.
So
yes.
It was that way back then.
Yes, it was very much that way, yeah. You look at the wages and jobs, and then you look at you know, corporate profits and so forth, very much the same. You see, you can get a profit recovery in one of two ways. You can get it from a robust economy and consumer demand picking up and selling more goods, or you can get it by squeezing your workforce. And that's how these profits have been generated. They haven't been generated because of increased sales. They've been generated because of free money, first of all, and secondly, by squeezing the labor force. That's why we still have 25 million unemployed. You know, we've taken it out on the labor force, and in terms of wages, in terms of benefits, in terms of jobs. You know, we've hired 1.8 million people since the official end of the recession in June 2009, and they make a big deal about that. But that's only like 100,000 jobs a month on average, and we have 130 to 150,000 new people every month entering the labor force, so we're still going backwards in terms of jobs. I gave you the figures on foreclosures and the housing industry, which is down 75%, home prices falling again. We haven't stimulated the real economy, and that's because of Obama had the wrong strategy. You see, Obama's strategy was bail out the banks, as his banker advisors, all of them, told him, and then just put a floor under the continuing collapse of consumption because of all the unemployment for about a year. And the argument was, okay, after a year, the private sector will take over and will continue generating the recovery, right? They'll start hiring after a year, year and a half. Well, the stimulus, to what extent there was a consumption stimulus, and there was about $400 billion in consumption stimulus in Obama's 2009 bill, bailing out the states and the cities, or subsidizing them, actually, for about a year, year and a half, and subsidizing the unemployed with COBRA and unemployment insurance and so forth, a holding action. A holding action, not a jobs program at all, because the jobs program was supposed to be done by the private sector. Well, a year and a half later, the private sector's got $2 trillion, and it's sitting on it. Obama went and talked to the Chamber of Commerce in February, and he said, hey, you know, what's going on, fellas? You're supposed to be creating jobs. And they looked at him, and they said, virtually said to him, I read some of the comments, look, we're businesses. If there's no one buying our goods, we're not going to expand and produce more goods. You see, that's the strategic error that Obama made. Not enough fiscal stimulus, not enough direct government-driven job creation. I wrote an article for Z Magazine in February this year, and it was entitled, How to Create 15 Million Jobs. And I showed how you can do it without raising the budget deficit $1. And you do it by restructuring the tax system and raising money to pay for direct government-created jobs. That's what we have to do. Otherwise, we're going to have a decade of 25 million unemployed. The government goes into a direct job creation program, creating public investment, alternative energy, and so forth in a significant way. You know, only $27 billion of the $787 billion in Obama's stimulus package was real direct job creation. $27 billion. There was no job program, and there still is no job program except, you know, stimulate exports, which isn't going to do anything. There was no program to save 10 million foreclosures. The whole strategy there when housing was let those people get out of those homes and sell it to new home buyers. Didn't work.
For sure. Jobs program, Jack, is rhetoric more than fact, and the so-called employment numbers that come out every month, they're really rigged numbers because we have this fictitious job creation, supposedly small business creating so many jobs, over 200,000 a month, and in times like this, the formula may work very well during good times when small businesses are hiring and are creating jobs. But during times like now, you simply can't invent a number out of thin air and say, the formula is that in good times and bad, that small businesses create X number of jobs every month. Mm-hmm. So we're literally coming up with a number that is the figment of the imagination of the people putting out these labor reports.
Yeah, that's the new business birth death model, plug-in number. You know, which is the statistic and not an estimate of any kind of job creation or employment. You're absolutely right, and that's how you mitigate the actual number of jobs lost. You know, the decline in the unemployment rate here from 9-something to about 9 here, low nines in the last 6 months, is almost wholly explainable by the fact that you've got over 500,000 people leaving the labor force in the last several months. You know, because of the funny way they calculate unemployment, if you leave the labor force, of course, you're still unemployed, but you're not calculated in the unemployment rate. That's called the U3 unemployment rate. The U6 is still, which factors in some some consideration of this development and the shift to part-time underemployment, which we still have 9 million people, is around 15-16%, and that's an underestimate. It really, the unemployment rate is really around 18% right now, and it hasn't budged. That's the important thing. And in fact, now in the last couple of weeks, all of a sudden, new jobless claims are going through the window again. They're up well over 400,000. You see, to have a net gain in employment, the new jobless claims have to be down around 350,000 a month. Well, we're running 50 to 70,000 a month above that. They may be surprised on May 5th, when the unemployment numbers come out for April. They may be surprised, but as you say, this plug-in number mitigates the actual unemployment levels. That plug-in number, by the way, for the new birth-death model increases always in the spring. That's why it always appears in the spring. Oh, gee, we're turning the corner, right? The light at the end of the corner, jobs are looking better. And then in the summer, they collapse again.
Well, Jack, you know, it's like a Hollywood script. I mean, you can write a script to look rosy or to look dire. And they have jerry-rigged the way that they compute the numbers, whether it's employment, whether it's on inflation, so many of the numbers, and they come out with these rosy scenarios or scenarios that don't look quite as bad as they really are, and it's creating an economic recovery out of whole cloth.
Both the jobs numbers, employment numbers, and the you're absolutely right, and the price numbers are they've constructed them over the decades so that they've reduced volatility on both the up and the downside. You know, so it doesn't rise too high and doesn't go too low, and it stays within a narrow, more or less stable range. You know, but what we've got going on now is so dramatic that even the stable range has been exceeded, you might say. And economists are now saying they don't see how they can get the unemployment rate down much below 9, so they're saying, well, this is going to be the new normal. Get used to it. Mm-hmm. The new normal, by the way, used to be 4.5% before the crisis. Now, all of a sudden, it's twice that. Of course, they don't explain why. My normal is twice as bad as it used to be.
You know, I remember a term that Larry Summers used, I think back in the 1980s. I don't know what he was, maybe he was a professor back then, but he wrote an article, and I quoted him, many months back in an article I wrote, and the term he used was hysteresis. It comes from the Greek, and I don't remember the exact translation. But what he was talking about, he was talking about the European job situation. They had very high unemployment, I guess, back in the 80s, and he referred to it basically as a permanent state. And this is what they have, I guess, maybe at that time having no idea that what was going on in Europe in the 1980s now is going on in America. I haven't heard him talk about hysteresis lately.
Yeah. Let's talk about the deficit.
Okay.
You know, this is coming up next couple of weeks, the debt and the deficit. I just wrote a piece called Republicans, Democrats, and the $14.3 trillion U.S. debt, and that people can access and read on my blog, jackrasmus.com. But here's some facts people should consider as these debates come up. In 2000, a little over a decade ago, the total federal government debt was about $5 trillion. Now it's $14.3 trillion. So we've added $9.3 trillion to federal debt in just 10 years. Okay? Now, let's take a look at where it came from. If you look at the Pentagon, Pentagon's budget, the Defense Department's budget, has increased at an annual rate of 8.2% per year for the whole decade. That compares to a 2% CPI price increase for all of us. Okay, so the Pentagon budget rising more than four times as fast as the consumer price index. If the Pentagon was allowed to increase its budget at the same rate that all the rest of us dealt with prices, 2% per year, instead of 8.2%, we would have spent $1.526 trillion less less than we spent. Okay, so that's $1.5 trillion of the $9.3 trillion added. Now, that doesn't count the supplemental war spending for Iraq and Afghanistan, and who knows what it is for Libya now. The supplemental war spending is another $1.3 trillion. So war-related spending added $3.38 trillion to our total debt in the last 10 years.
Jack, I saw a number just recently on Libya so far on the order of $500 million.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, each time they shoot a cruise missile, it's several million dollars.
Oh.
Now, incredible. Okay, so that's $3.38 trillion on defense. Let's take the Bush tax cuts, $3.4 trillion over the decade. Add them, and then another $400 billion we just passed here. So $3.8 trillion, the Bush tax cuts. So what do we got? We got about $7 trillion just in Bush tax cuts and defense spending. $7 trillion of the $9 trillion. Now, where do you get the other $2 trillion? Unfunded Part D, prescription drugs, Medicare, unfunded. Passed the prescription drugs program, which is really a pharmaceutical subsidy bill. And that costs about $1 trillion. And then how about the direct bailouts? Okay, that's about another $1.5 trillion. And then you have the escalating costs, healthcare costs of, double-digit healthcare costs almost every year here. That's put a tremendous pressure on Medicaid and Medicare costs. Okay, the crisis in Medicaid and Medicare largely attributed to insurance companies and healthcare costs escalating. The Obamacare bill last year is going to be a failure because it did nothing virtually about controlling healthcare costs. So you add those all up, health companies, right, bailouts, war spending, Bush tax cuts, there's your $9 trillion. Now, are we talking about focusing on the causes of the debt run-up at all? No, we're trying to blame the poor. We're trying to blame the seniors. We're trying to blame public employees, all these other programs. You know, the Paul Ryan bill focuses on Medicare, cutting Medicare and Medicaid. That's where these Republican governors are going, cut Medicare and Medicaid. And that's just the start for them. In other words, the folks who haven't caused the debt are going to have to pay for the debt. Sounds like Greece, doesn't it?
Sounds like Greece.
It's
and it's not just the Republicans, Jack. It's Obama. Obama, a year ago, planned to lop $500 billion off Medicare, and I think he wants to lop another $500 billion off Medicare. So the
you're absolutely right here. Obama loves Paul Ryan because Paul Ryan and the Republicans give him a right cover.
Oh, they sure do.
Because Obama and the Deficit Commission, which are, you know, the real corporate powers that be, that deficit, you know, the Simpson-Bowles deficit proposal is really where the big wealthy are coming from. That's what they want. Now it makes him, Obama, when he teams up with Simpson-Bowles, which is what's happening, Obama's going to propose Simpson-Bowles. And it's going to look like, oh, it's not as bad as the Republicans and Paul Ryan. So, Paul Ryan's a perfect, and the Republicans are a perfect event for them to push through Simpson-Bowles.
I think
they're already teaming up, Obama and the Gang of Six, as they call them. They're pushing the Simpson-Bowles in the Senate. And that's the debate. Instead of focusing on the real causes of the deficit and debt, they're focusing on making the people pay for it when they didn't cause it.
But they really are, Jack. And as bad as Obama's policies have been, what the Republicans want to do are so off the charts in extremism that they make a bad administration look good. And come 2012, I honestly believed not too long ago that Obama would be a one-term president. And yet, the Republicans are making him look so good that he's probably going to be a two-term president, because who the heck wants to go from the frying pan into the fire? Jack,
I'm not so sure that will be the outcome. But maybe we can discuss that next time, as well as what are some other real solutions to the crisis.
Oh, indeed. Indeed.
I mean, we can talk all day on what's caused it, but we ought to be talking about what's, a popular program that's not the programs you're hearing.
Exactly. Jack, I wish we could keep this thing going. I thank you very much. I look forward to next month. You have a good weekend.
You do. Bye.
Thank you, Jack. And tune in tomorrow. We will have another program with another frequent guest on this program. And it'll be wide-ranging. We may get into the economy, but we certainly will cover other things. And my guest's latest writing, I'm talking about John Cozy. Do join us then, same time.